concert series overlooking the river at Harbor Park in Middletown every Tuesday at 7 p.m. through September 1st. The Rain location is South Church.
Today's show is called When Life Happens. I'll be talking to two women about their unique and personal journeys to new husbands, new lives, and new passions, one to religion and the other to writing. Somewhat in midlife, both have embraced a newfound spirituality and purpose in their personal and professional lives. Anne Shaibani is the author of How to Eat the Elephant, Build Your Book in Bite-Sized Steps. She received her master's in creative writing and literature from Harvard University. She is the director of the East Hill Writers Workshop, a local and online source of instruction and feedback for blossoming writers. As a book coach, she helps speakers and coaches write and publish books that attract many clients. She's currently working on a memoir about her impetuous decision to win over a man and the result in 5 years she spent living with him in the Islamic Republic of Iran. She is an expert on aimlessness, people-pleasing, and finding one's voice. Elaine Walker is a mom of six, yours, mine, and ours, kids and grandmother of six as well. A former corporate trainer, she is the owner of Angel Hair and Care, a mobile haircutting service, and reverend of Open Arms Christian Ministries. Having been a single mom for 3 years, her marriage changed her life course from innate spirituality to outward manifestations of religious service. She finds passion in connecting people to less worldliness and more godliness. Welcome, Anne and Elaine.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you. So, Anne, why don't you start a little bit and tell me about your life? You can give me the Reader's Digest version.
Oh, Lord. So I came out of college with a chemistry degree back in 1985. And for most people, they would think, you know, to come out with a chemistry degree, you're going to light the world on fire. You've got a really marketable career. But instead, I felt absolutely horrified because I had gone into chemistry to impress some guy, and I had no scientific curiosity, and I was looking down the barrel at having a career being in a laboratory, and it was incredibly boring to me. So I decided that I wanted to take the easy way out, and my brilliant idea to avoid having to work in the chemical industry, was I was going to get married. And unfortunately, I was one of these very aimless young women who had no idea what I wanted. I had no vision. I had no idea how I even thought about the world or what I felt or what my needs were. So when I took a look at my teaching assistant who was getting his PhD in physical chemistry, he was a pro-Khomeini revolutionary, a Muslim from Iran, from a small village. I thought he was totally cute, and that looked like a good idea to me. And so I courted him and wooed him, and eventually we got married under, you know, just all the drama that is associated with that kind of stuff. And I ended up following him to Iran. And this is just right after Khomeini died, so 1990, the beginning of 1990. And at this point, I was bringing with me a two-month-old infant, our daughter.
That's amazing.
And, yeah.
You know, and it's amazing and it's not, because I'm sure that you could replace the man, the time, the place, and you'd be speaking for so many other women, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it's looking for somebody else to save you. It's looking for somebody else to create a life for you, to map it all out. And I thought, you know, here's somebody who's exotic, somebody who's, you know, if you're getting a PhD, you're intelligent, you're going places. And yet, you know, he, God bless his soul, he's dead now. He had a plan, and his plan was to go back to his home country and to, you know, to participate and to contribute to society, a society that he felt like he had fought for. So he had a very definite plan. He knew what he wanted. And I think the fact that he had very strong opinions, he had a very strong compass. It was so appealing to me because I was completely rudderless. We went there, and it's not that he was a bad man. He was actually a really decent human being, but I was so way in over my head, and I was not a person who was meant to be in Iran. I didn't have any strong religious leanings one way or another. And for him, his faith was a centering point for him. He very much wanted me to participate. Like right now, we're in the heart of Ramadan, which is a month of fasting for Muslims. And Ramadan used to be like a nightmare for me because it completely changed up how I would live my life, and it was a contention point because he wanted me to be a practicing Muslim, and I don't own that. You know, it's not part of who I am. It was really tough culturally. And after 5 years, I came home with our two kids by that time on vacation. And I decided to stay. And I decided to stay because it was the first point that I came face to face with the fact that I was so deeply unhappy that I was getting horrible migraine headaches. I mean, I was so disassociated from my own feelings that I could not have told you how unhappy I was.
I think this is every woman's story to some degree, especially women who, for many reasons, haven't found their place in their bodies, in their lives, with men. We're talking today with two women about when life happens, and I think all of us would agree that we're here to share with you, the listener, so that you may learn, and if not learn, at least find some sort of support, consolation, and maybe even inspiration that life doesn't always have to be exactly as it hands itself to you, and you don't always have to follow the path of your partner. You know, you find your own moral compass and you move forward. So what would be the conclusion of that portion of your story?
Well, you know, I came back and I had to start over all over again. And all of those decisions that most people are making at 21 right out of college, I had to make those for myself at I was maybe 31, 32, and I had two kids. So I had to figure out what I was going to do and, you know, who I wanted to be, which was tough because when you're, you know, a mom and you're married, you tend to identify yourself as a mom and a wife. So I had to totally recreate myself. And it's a lot harder with two kids than it is when you're coming out of school at the age of 21.
So let me stop you there, and let's go to Elaine Walker, who is our second mother. Elaine, tell me a little bit about your what your story is and where did it lead you?
Well, my story's pretty typical to, I think, a young woman growing up in a small town of Stafford Springs in Connecticut. You know, I grew up with fairly little expectations. I'm a product of two middle-class, very hardworking parents. You know, kind of floundered around, spent some time in college, but really always wanted to be a hairdresser. I have fond memories of my mom getting her hair set week after week. And, you know, it led me to Hartford, Connecticut, which for me was, you know, the big time big city, and also led me to quite a promiscuous lifestyle and partying and somewhat going from relationship to relationship, but also always knowing that I had deep rooted spiritual beginnings. And, you know, growing up Catholic in a small town, I definitely had a strong sense of what was right and what was wrong. And, you know, through the years, when I moved to Hartford, I, you know, worked in the restaurant industry for many years. And then I moved on to finally my pursuit of doing hair. I worked at Sage Allen in downtown Hartford. And believe it or not, I ended up as a corporate trainer for Supercuts. And, you know, through that experience, I found myself wanting bigger things in life. I was had the opportunity to travel nationally. But through that pursuit, was also still hoping, you know, to have that long-lasting relationship and somewhat follow my mother's path of being domestic and being in the home.
What age are we talking about that you did all of this?
Well, you
in
know,
your 20s or 30s?
And 20s. Mm-hmm. Yep, my 20s and in between. But I think my defining moment was really when I did end up in as a single woman in corporate America, early realizing in 1987 that it's a different world for a woman in America traveling and, you know, trying to truly find myself.
So I do know that you became a mother. At what age did you become a mother?
I didn't become a mother till I was 33 years old.
And I'm taking that as a single mother, correct?
I was a single mother at the time, yes. And you know, infatuated with, you know, a fellow coworker in hopes that through the conception of my son that it would hopefully lead to marriage, and learned very quickly that we had two different mindsets on what marriage would be. So finding myself in, you know, corporate America, single mom, saving grace is that I had a newly retired dad that was able to support me, and also decided at that point to practice celibacy and to not involve myself in any relationships while I was bringing up my son, but still in strong pursuit of my spirituality and...
And your life's passion, your life's work?
And my life's work, yes.
And so let's pick you back up. So here you are with two children.
Can I add one thing, Sema, because it's such an interesting point that Elaine just raised?
Yeah, sure.
Is that so many young women use pregnancy as a way of making life happen. And I had done the same thing when I was, you know, trying to encourage my my then-to-be husband to marry me. You know, he was the smart one that said, you know, we're so different that I don't really think that that's going to work out. I always planned on going back to Iran and marrying my cousin, who was, a village virgin. And the fact that I was an American, that I was not a virgin, it was going to be a huge, huge problem for him, particularly if I went back to Iran with him. You know, culturally, that would have been a big no-no. And so to move my hand, to make my hand stronger, you know, I ended up getting pregnant. And it was very much a design to force the issue and to, you know, put him on the line. And it could have gone either way. And he, you know, definitely bit for it, and that's how we ended up married. But I mean, you know, it's such a common thing, and I would warn my own kids about doing that. My son, I would go out and say, look, it happens all the time. When a woman does not know how to make something happen, it is a really useful tool, and it's the oldest game in the book. And you know, smart women do that.
The interesting thing, Ann, about this is that we are all products of the 60s and the 70s. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, we learned our lessons through Gloria Steinem and really did learn that it was possible to stand on our own, to become the people we were hoping to be without a man. And yet, in so much of our almost DNA programming, we still go against that.
Yeah, it was new. I mean, those ideas take, you know, a generation or two to really lock down, because not only did we have Gloria Steinem, you know, we had our mothers, and if our mothers are our biggest role models, my mother latched on to a guy. She held on to her man because that's how she was going to be able to support herself and her kids. So, you know, you can have Gloria Steinem out there waving that flag, but if you witness your own mother, you know, putting up with crap in a relationship that you wouldn't put up with, but you understand her reasoning, that's going to be a stronger influence than somebody out there coming up with these ideas.
Absolutely.
That are going to take a while to take hold.
Absolutely. Elaine?
Yeah, and interesting, you know, I guess I did leave out a big chunk of my story that, you know, when I did conceive Isaiah, I was actually studying at the seminary. And, you know, to walk in month after month as my belly got bigger and bigger, I really did feel, you know, the judgment of being a single mom, which is ironic in 1995, as a mature woman. And, you know, I was also faced with the diversity of, you know, walking and still following that path as I was preparing to get into the ministry. Definitely not a, you know, atypical way to enter your ministry 9 months pregnant. Pretty much going against everything that the, you know, the church states, but definitely was a definition in my life.
We're talking today to two women, Ann Shabani and Elaine Walker, about when life happens. And again, for you, the listener, we're hoping that these stories resonate with you, that you can find yourself in the faux pas that they feel they've made, but also the inspirational and supportive conversation we hope to have about where their lives have gone. And so here you are with two children. And what was the impetus which changed the direction of your life? And how old were you?
I came back from Iran. I was maybe 31 or 32. And I immediately started eating. I was living with my mother. I started eating everything in the refrigerator that I had missed by living in Iran for so long. And I put on 20 pounds. And I was sitting with a girlfriend looking at magazines, and on the back cover of this magazine was this image of a woman running, and she had the most gorgeous, fit, strong, strong body. And I, you know, told my girlfriend, you know, I want a body like that. And it just immediately dawned on me that if I want a body like that, I would actually have to run. And so the two of us just started running very, very slowly, and I had never liked running. And for whatever reason, just by a fluke, it actually took. I learned how to run. I didn't run out too fast, and little by little, I became a runner, and it became a regular part of my day. And what happened with running, besides losing weight, besides feeling remarkably powerful, is it became an activity where I could actually hear myself think. And one of the, you know, one of my downfalls as a young woman is I didn't know what I thought. I did my damnedest to keep from connecting with how I felt or what was going on in my head. And suddenly I'm out there for 3 or 4 miles a day. I had enough space to begin to connect with myself. And at first that was really uncomfortable for me. I started to think very differently about myself. I started to associate with people who were runners as well. And all of a sudden, besides the connection to myself, I began connecting very deeply to people I would run with on a daily basis. And we would just talk for miles and miles about life and run-of-the-mill stuff. So all of a sudden, I was getting fed that way. You know, within probably a 2 or 3 year period, I began running marathons. And you know, I crossed the finish line of the Hartford Marathons the first time. And I don't even know what year this was, probably 98 maybe. And something changed in me. It was this sudden recognition that I had taken on something really huge on my own. And I had overcome any number of obstacles, finding a sitter for the kids on a Saturday morning long run, injuries, pain, just the running in heat, all of these things that normally would have stopped me. You know, I'm one of these people that always got stopped by the first obstacle. And the culmination of finishing that race, something that I never thought I was capable of doing, flipped a switch in me, and that moment became a touchstone for me. Because I recognized that if I could do that, I could probably do a lot of things that required tenacity, which was something that I really didn't think I had up to that point. And it was one of those things that made me decide to go back to school and study something that I actually wanted to study. I mean, you know, I'd never been interested in chemistry. I had, you know, curiosity, and I wanted to write. And I began going back and forth to Harvard, of all places. I would drive 2 hours each way a couple of times a week while I was working to study writing. And while I was studying writing, you know, essentially I was writing about my life. I was writing stories about people I had known in Iran and situations I had been in, or the stories of, you know, like amazingly horrible stories of other people I had known. And I began to really understand what had happened, not just to me, but inside of me, what had made somebody like me so susceptible to doing some really dumb crap like that. And by writing my way through it, draft after draft after draft, I became very, very in tune with what made me tick. And a lot of the stories that I was telling were really shame-based stories. I mean, I had a lot of guilt. I'd been really manipulative. I had a lot of shame about some of the things that I put up with. You know, my husband had taken a second wife for a brief period of time. Things I had never told my mother about what I was capable of putting up with, because I didn't want her to say, hey, you, I was right, look what happened to you. And so by working through a lot of those shame-based stories, I began to develop a message from my mess. And I began a relationship with myself that was far more self-accepting, far more understanding. And so when I walked into a room, the combination of feeling pretty powerful by being a runner and being able to endure and overcome obstacles, and by getting to know myself and to forgive myself and deeply understand what kind of motivation was going on, how my life probably could not have turned out very differently, you know, up to that point.
Sure.
It changed who I was and how I related to people in general.
So, Elaine, there you are. You're 9 months pregnant. You're at the seminary. And so take us forward. And also share with us, what was the impetus which changed the direction of your life? I would like to know how old you were. And in that change, did that help you capture your authentic self?
Well, I was 33 when I graduated seminary. And I think the challenge is much like Ann said, is like the shame and the guilt of, you know, being pregnant and being in this atmosphere. But the strong feeling of support, specifically from my mother and father, that, you know, they could stand with me there and see that even though I was not going down the road that the church maybe would advocate, that this was going to happen, that I was going to birth this child and this was going to happen. And at that moment when I did birth Isaiah and realized that, you know, this is the beginning of my life with this child, and that, you know, there's no turning back. You know, that was when I really became devoted to not only my spirituality, but being a mom, and knowing at 33 years old that this was it.
It's an interesting story that for one of you, having a child created the impetus for change, and for the other one of you, it's about running, and it's about finding your voice. Ultimately, though, those two experiences have brought both of you to very similar places. So, Elaine, here you are with a young child. You find that you have started a new pathway for authenticity. So who now gets you, who moves you forward? Who are some of the role models? How did you make some choices that you probably would have felt were healthier? And what aspect of yourself did you need to face in going through this experience to know that there was a different path for you?
I think my role models have always been my mother and father, and it's just a strong work ethic that's always been ingrained in me. And, you know, being a faith-based person, and I, you know, surrounded myself with leadership in the church, and surrounded myself with role models that were probably everyday role models. You know, I thought about, you know, Martin Luther King, and I actually thought about Martha Washington, about, you know, these incredible role models in history. But for me, it's the everyday person. It's Anne, it's you, Sima, it's watching people overcome adversity, that these truly are my role models. And this is where, you know, I go with it every day. My husband right now is my role model. And, you know, meeting him after, you know, 3 years of not dating and knowing that I could enter into this relationship.
Be a stronger person? I mean, it sounds to me as if you could not have met him prior to the time in which you did. You would not have been ready. You did not see yourself.
No, definitely not. As a matter of fact, I made a vow. I made a spiritual vow that, you know, while being a single mom, I wasn't going to allow a man in my home. And, you know, my biggest test is that he can take my son, he can take me. And, you know, when I met my husband, Mark, our first date was in church. We had a guest minister that day. So after a five-hour church service, I knew that he really meant business. And it was an instantaneous attraction between him and my son. And that was it. That was the change.
So before we move forward, and so there you are, you have two children. Take us up to the point at which you meet your husband.
So, oh, that's a great question. I was single for 12 years, and I had a very similar philosophy to Elaine, where I did not really want men around my kids. I didn't want to expose them to people coming in and out my door. That if they were going to be exposed to somebody, it was going to be somebody I was going to be married to. And I was pretty afraid of the concept of marriage for a very long time, because what I had experienced, what I had come to decide was marriage, was not something I wanted to re-enter. So if I dated, I was usually dating highly unavailable men, and I was doing it on the down low, out of my kids' purview. Number one, because I didn't want to have people in and out of their lives, and number two, my ex-husband at the time was still alive, and he was at the time living in the United States, and I had this overwhelming paranoia that if he saw me dating somebody, he would snatch the kids and take them back to Iran. And I didn't want to create that kind of scene, and I didn't want to stir him up, because one of the things he had told me when we were divorcing is, no man will ever treat your children well. They will take advantage of them, and if I see another man around, I will, you know, I'll take the kid. And, you know, part of that, the paranoia was, well, maybe he's right. Maybe if someone's around my kids, they won't treat them like their own. And my first sense of responsibility was to my kids, and most mothers feel that way. And by the time I met my husband, I met him through Match.com. I was done dating unavailable men. I had gone on a bicycle trip in France, and I had run into a few couples that had been together for maybe 30 or 40 years, and some of them were Mormon, and their sense of community, their sense of family, their sense of engagement and common values with each other was so appealing to me. And it was probably that light bulb moment that a marriage could be something very different than what I had decided it was in my own head. So I lost that fear. So when I came back, I decided I wanted to model that. I wanted to find somebody who had a very similar set of values to me. I wanted somebody who understood and had their own kids, because when you have your own kids, there's an automatic, I think, compassion and empathy and an understanding of how you need your kids to be treated by somebody else. And when I sat down across the table from Walt, there was an immediate attraction. There was the commonality. We were both endurance athletes. We were both longtime learners. We were both really into books and writing and words, and we had an amazing conversation. So, you know, I was on a series of interview dates that week or that month and met tons of great people, and I knew instantly that this is someone who deeply understood me, that was totally okay with the nut job I am, because I put that out on the table right up front.
You can't see Elaine shaking her head, but I think you both share that. Yes.
Yeah, I didn't want to fool anyone. I didn't want to manipulate anybody. I wanted to have the, you know, buyer beware sticker right up front, because I had spent so many years pretending to be somebody that I wasn't, that I didn't want to go down that path again. And so my clarity about who I was and my clarity for what I knew, or deeply suspected at least, what would work for me in a man and in a partnership, and what I really wanted was right on the table. And so, that kind of clarity, I cannot recommend highly enough.
So, Elaine, I'm guessing you're nodding. I'm sorry, yes. Elaine is just nodding away. So I'm guessing that your experience with Mark was the same thing.
Totally. It's so similar, actually. It's funny you should say nut job, because I'd probably call myself a spaz when I met Mark. I mean, when I first met Mark, I was described as, you know, the workaholic manager of a hair cutting salon that all she does is be with her kids and go to church. And when I met Mark, pretty much instantaneous that there was an attraction. I would say, you know, I'm used to that physical attraction, but there was a spiritual connection and a spiritual attraction that was much greater than the physical attraction.
Let's move forward. We're now talking about both of you, assuming that you're probably in your 40s. It's clear to me that your prior experiences most definitely set the foundation for what ensued. But do you think that wisdom can only be accomplished through age? For that question, I guess, do you think women must have a lifetime of experiences to actually recognize and access their true selves? Ian?
Oh, you know, I love that question, because I have run into some of the most remarkably in-tuned and insightful young women. I mean, women in their late teens even, and their 20s. And, I suppose I would call them an anomaly, because you can't really expect so much from an 18-year-old or a 22-year-old. But, you know, maybe it's because I've sat across people writing, and I think when you tend to write, or you've got a story that you're trying to tell at a very young age, with that comes a lot of insight, or, you know, insight becomes a byproduct of that work. And so I've been astounded by young women who really, truly understand themselves and understand the world and I would, you know, that they would make me say no to that. And I've also run into some much older women in their, you know, 70s or 80s who so lack insight, who so have not learned, who have repeated the same damn mistake over and over again, or if they haven't repeated, like, a marriage mistake, they're so afraid of themselves that they've created such a small life and to keep themselves safe that there's no trust, there's no, you know, that they have failed my test of what it is to grow and risk things and develop. So I don't think it's, I don't think, you know, we older women or, you know, even our big sisters, I don't think we have the market cornered. I think it's personality, quite frankly, and I think there are incidents that seem really horrible on the surface, but allow you know, the turn of the switch for you to change how you think and change how you believe. And it's not usually the good things in life that make those changes happen. It's usually the crappy things.
So, again, Elaine is shaking her head. I find it so interesting that you are both such different women. You actually have had so many differing experiences, and yet you're in the same place. Mm-hmm. And the thing that strikes me the most about both of you is that Elaine has talked about the godliness, the worldliness in everyday people, in everyday experiences, and helping them to open up and find themselves and find their passions and to get centered. And Anne, you obviously do that through teaching your writings and through encouraging others to write. You must be looking for that godliness, that worldliness, that centered quality that expresses the truth of someone's life, correct?
Yeah. You know, here's what's funny, because I always say that I'm about as spiritual as a Big Mac. And, you know, it's sort of a joke because it's not really true. I mean, I've never felt the calling of an organized religion. It's just never been part of my MO. But it doesn't mean that I'm not spiritual, because some of the people, some of the books and some of the ideas that have most impacted me are written by really deeply spiritual people. Annie Lamott, for instance, who wrote Traveling Mercies. You know, she wrote about just what a cock-up she was as a young woman, and the addictions and abortions and, you know, relationships with men. And that what turned her around for her, it was finding a church, it was finding a community, it was finding God. And it was grace that allowed her to forgive herself. And, you know, her motto is, we're only as sick as our secrets. And I think it's that connection with a community, a spiritual community. It is the ability to confess your sins, for lack of a better expression. You know, I'll go with, you know, the more traditional line. It is putting it out there and allowing yourself to forgive yourself. It's allowing yourself grace. That is so completely appealing to me. And another one is Mary Carr, who wrote the book Lit. And it's her own struggles with alcoholism and finding her way out through God. I think she went traditionally very Catholic, which was, you know, so against the way she was raised. But those journeys, you know, that reaching out for how do you forgive yourself? How do you allow grace in to your life? I mean, I think I would be called a, you know, I'm not Catholic and I'm not Buddhist and I'm not Muslim. I'm probably a grace-ist. Because I think your ability to wash your soul of all that crap is a gorgeous gift to yourself and to those people who depend on you.
Yeah, and I all I can say is amen to that.
Yeah.
You know, it is that grace that's the free gift that we get. And, you know, that's basically, you know, my plight right now in life is to, you know, bring that grace to others and let them know that it's really not something that you have to work for, but it's something that's natural, and each one of us have that gift. And what I've realized is through this life is that it's the selflessness that we, you know, give to others, and that we're, you know, willing to give to others. And as you know, I take this, I know we're talking about our children and our families, but as we talk about our individual pathways, I have to say that I read something this morning that we all have these incredible intentions, but it's that one action. And, you know, that action right now can't be seen because we're talking through a microphone. It may just be that smile. And, you know, that's the motivation that gets me through, and my spirit, and you know, my faith base. Although it is in a congregation, and what I find is that, you know, empowerment comes through that the others that we're able to serve, as my husband and I minister to a new church. And so
the one word that is such an interesting word for me, and it's selfless. And for a lot of years I lacked self. I lacked the concept of who I was as an individual. I always saw myself as in relation to somebody else. You know, I grew up in one of these really heavily dysfunctional families where codependency ends up being a carpet bag that you carry out with you. A lot of people who come from either an alcoholic background or, you know, a parent with mental illness, you know, a whole bunch of dysfunctions. I really struggle with the idea of someone being selfish, because I think it's so easy to hone in on everybody else's needs and wants to the exclusion of your own, that you don't know where you begin and where others begin, and you don't know where you end and others begin. And I read a wonderful book by a Christian writer. His name was Dr. Henry Cloud, and he wrote the book Boundaries. And at first, you know, I got turned off by the book because he dipped into a lot of Bible talk, and he dipped into, you know, there was a lot of God talk, which is something that beforehand would have sent me reeling the other way. And it was such a compelling book that I forgave the God talk. And it was about what it is to be an incredibly giving, loving human being, and to be, you know, in his case, it was to be a good Christian, but to protect your own boundaries and to be aware of your own needs. And as somebody who is so detached from her own needs and wants, for me, the idea of selfishness or being unselfish is such a slippery slope. I'm someone who's more of a proponent that you've got to include yourself in the equation. It has to be. You've got to be able to take care of yourself and, first of all, identify your needs, wants, and desires, and then be able to take some daily action to feed that so you're stronger for everybody else. So, I think you and I can have a conversation for days about what selfless means, because it's a slippery slope, and I'd love to hear your thoughts.
It's interesting. It is a slippery slope, and I have to say, entering my marriage, yours, mine, and ours, so bring to the family 3 stepchildren, 1 child of mine, and 2 that came later, a family of 6, that what I find when I say the word selflessness is that as much as I'd like to have control over my everyday life, it's through the selflessness that I find my gratitude. Because, you know, being a former control freak, I found that through that selflessness, I find my gratification through that one act that kind of gets me through. And I find so often that my schedule is interrupted by others, that being able to kind of go with the flow has served me better as I grow on in years. And it is interesting.
Wouldn't you call that giving it over to something bigger than yourself, which is another concept that I totally love?
Absolutely.
Because as a control freak, I have been brought to my knees saying, I can't do it all. Let me give it over to something bigger than myself. Let me stop trying to manage it and control it all.
We're talking today to 2 wonderful women about when life happens. And I have an image of all of the women, especially in their cars right now. They've pulled over to the side because they almost swerved when you just said that. I think that trying to give it up and trying to let go of control, especially for women, is the theme of the 21st century. There are so many factors that are coming at us, and, you know, these blended step families and increasingly complicated family structures, the age of technology, the differing role models, kind of creates a zeitgeist where I'm not sure that we do have much choice but to give it all up. We're starting to run out of time, so I would like to move forward and just ask you, Ian, what do you do to honor yourself, to take care of yourself? And then the second part of the question is, what aspect of yourself do you still feel you would like to work on? And do you think you'll ever get there?
I love those questions. So I, for my personality to manage my squirrel head, I have to run. And when I have to run probably 5 days a week. And when I go running, it's like 6 miles. And by the time, it's not that I love running, because when I'm out there, it's like, oh, God, it's hot, and I really don't want to run today. But it's the way I manage my personality. It's the way I create space for myself. So when I don't do it within 3 days, you don't want to be around me. So that's first and foremost. I learned that I have to really watch my calories, and I have to manage the kind of nutrition that I put in my face, because if I get too anxious or if my life starts getting hectic, my tendency is to root around in the refrigerator and use food as a tamping down device. So I've got to be very, very cognizant, very aware of what I eat and how I'm feeding myself. That's a big way that I take care of myself. And I do 3 morning pages each day. Julia Cameron, who wrote The Artist's Way, talked about a practice where you sit down and you write everything, all that squirrel stuff that's in your head. You write it down in a notebook, 3 pages a day. And it's a lot like flushing your psychic toilet. And for someone who spent a lot of years so disassociated from what she was thinking or feeling, it is a tool that I will need to use probably the rest of my life, because I'm not naturally connected to myself. I have to work at knowing how I feel. Like, my husband will come in and he'll say, something's wrong. I'm like, no, everything's fine. What are you talking about? No, there's something going on with you. And I get annoyed, and I will go and I'll sit and I'll start writing about, you know, what a stupid idiot he is for asking me this dumb question, and why am I sitting here, like, trying to figure it out? And invariably, there's something there. So he's very tuned with the energies of other people. I am like a rock where I don't know what's going on, particularly with myself. So the thing that I have to work on, the thing that is going to probably be a lifetime, not a battle, but just a lifetime awareness, is that I don't always know how I feel. I generally don't know how I feel, and that's dangerous. So, and that's what I have to pay attention to.
We are winding down. Elaine, the same question for you, please, if you would. What do you do to honor yourself, to take care of yourself, and what aspect of yourself do you feel you need to work on?
I guess it's almost an overwhelming question. I think sleep, that's what I do to honor myself, because I'm such a doer, and I somewhat just don't know how to stop. And so lately, my spirit has been telling me to sleep. And through that sleep, I've been getting incredible revelation through dreams that are confirmation through everyday thoughts. So sleep and praying. And then the last thing is, I have to attach myself to a young person, whether it be a baby or someone who just isn't of age. And through that, I'm able to play and reconnect with that, and that just keeps me grounded.
So what one message would you like to give women listening today? We've been talking today to Anne Shabani and Elaine Walker about when life happens. This is fascinating. I'm sure we could have sat here for another couple of hours. But I think the premise here is that, number one, it doesn't always come with age that wisdom follows. Number two, that you can certainly make lemonade out of lemons. And number three, that there are multiple ways to find your center, to find your passion, to find your life's calling. Again, for Anne, it's been for writing, for teaching, and for Elaine, it's been spirituality, it's been ministering. And there are multiple ways for women to find their own calling, to find their own life purpose, to get centered in their lives. Again, what one message would you like to give, especially women listening today, Anne?
Oh, that's hard. I think it's really important to know what you want and to have a vision separate and apart from your relationships. And if we're going back to scripture, without a vision, they'll perish. It's so true. If you do not have a vision, and I cannot tell you the number of women I have worked with who are ashamed because they don't have a vision. They don't have the 10-year plan. They don't even know what they like anymore. You know, it's something that you can't let slide. It's something that, even though it's really uncomfortable and it's embarrassing to admit that, you know, you don't know where you're going or what you want or where your life's headed. You've got to develop one. And it's a matter of shopping for passions. It's a matter of trying new things and deciding if you like them or not, giving it enough time to, you know, to connect with it or not. But without that vision, you will be subject to everybody else's whims. You'll go where the road takes you, any road will do, and, you know, you end up in places like Iran like that.
Absolutely. Right. Elaine, what one message would you like to leave your listeners with today?
Make connections and stay involved. Go outside, walk, and talk with people. And that's how I find my greatest discoveries, is through talking with others.
I think for all of us, myself included, we so desperately want to help others find their own truth. I think that my own calling, my reason for doing this radio show, all three of us would say that our particular methods are intended to help women feel more grounded in their bodies, more aware of their own feelings, more passionate about the things that they'd like to accomplish in their lives. Would you all agree, ladies?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
We've been talking with Anne Shaibani and Elaine Walker today about their fascinating life journeys. Absolutely remarkable. You can learn more about Anne's services at www.buildabookbootcamp.com and find her on her blog site, www.annshaibani.com. Elaine Walker can be found at openarmschristianministries@gmail.com. I'd like to thank you, the listener, for coming along on the ride with us. I'm Sema Shapiro, your host of For Women Over 40. You're listening to WESU Middletown, 88.1 FM on your dial. And until next time, I hope you take care.